the conference call. So we'll get into that. I'll give the advisor's report. Lori's got a couple reports for some presentations. Can probably be a little briefer than they were. So Lori, I'll turn it over to Lori. She'll give us a presentation, and then I'll do the advisors. And then I have a series of motions from the committee.
Okay, I'm going to give you a brief, hopefully I'll try to be brief, overview of the herring specifications that were reviewed and analyzed by the PDT and addressed by the committee, along with a summary of the committee recommendations. Hopefully everybody has copies of my presentation. The first slide here, I'm not going to go through it. This is a reference slide for you, just all the acronyms that are used in the specs package and in the FMP. We have a whole lot of acronyms here, so this is a reference slide for you to take a look at the acronyms. I'm also going to skip over this slide in the interest of time. This is another reference slide, and this just provides you with section references and page numbers for the main elements of the specs document, including the description of the options for TACs, all of the updated stock and fishery information, and the various impacts discussions. Another reference slide, this is a table that provides our current fishery specifications. These are in effect this year for the 2009 fishing year, including a total OY of 145,000 and the various management area TACs underneath that. Very quickly, status of the herring stock complex. I think we've heard enough about that today, that everybody is clear that the stock is not overfished and overfishing is not occurring. We are actually very close to the biomass target for the stock complex as a whole. And these are numbers that came out of the recent 2009 track update. I think we're also very familiar with the next slide, which is the problem with the assessment. And this is just an illustration of the retrospective pattern that we have in the estimates of SSB, which has created the problems associated with the projections, estimating OFL, and, of course, the buffer that we have just discussed for most of today for specifying ABC. The next slide is, again, for reference purposes, provide you with some formulas that everyone should be generally familiar with as we go through the specs process. The OFL minus scientific uncertainty gives you your ABC. The ABC minus management uncertainty gives you your stock-wide catch limit or your optimum yield for the U.S. fishery. The Herring Committee has recommended that management uncertainty be specified at 14,800 metric tons for the next 3 years to account for Canadian catch as well as herring discards and state water catch. Once you derive your stock-wide catch limit or your U.S. optimum yield, that equals your domestic annual harvest plus any reserve you may set. And it also equals your sub-ACLs or your management area TACs plus any research set-asides you may set. Domestic annual harvest equals domestic annual processing plus joint venture processing plus border transfer. And joint venture processing, of course, has a state and a federal component. Okay, this slide doesn't really apply anymore. For 2010 through 12, these are the OFL levels, but as of right now, we are working with an ABC level of 106,000 metric tons. The committee was working with an ABC level of 90,000 metric tons, but we'll have that discussion later. In terms of management uncertainty, as I mentioned, you subtract this from your ABC to derive your stock-wide catch limit or your U.S. optimum yield. It's proposed at 14,800 metric tons, primarily to account for Canadian catch out of the New Brunswick weir fishery, which is all considered to be from the Atlantic herring stock complex and also all considered to be inshore fish from the inshore spawning component. State waters catch is minimal. The information in the document suggests that herring discards are low and insignificant relative to landings in the fishery and relative to the ability of preventing the ACLs from being exceeded. The committee recommendation is that current measures that allocate 5% of the TACs, when the directed fishery closes at 95% of the TAC, so the current measures that allocate 5% are sufficient to account for management uncertainty related to incidental catch, state waters catch, and discards in the fishery. So the 14,800 metric ton management uncertainty buffer accounts for Canadian catch in the New Brunswick weir fishery. The committee identified a series of options for taking that U.S. optimum yield and dividing it between the management areas. There is a table, I believe it's on page 31. Let me just double check that. Table on page 31 of the specs document, which has the numbers associated with these options. But just briefly, option one is based on the catch distribution from 1999 to 2008. Option two is based on the TAC allocations for the 2001 fishing year. There are actually two options here, one incorporating a reserve for Area 2 because that was in place in 2001, and option 2A does not incorporate the Area 2 reserve. Option three was developed based on the same TAC allocations that we have this year in 2009, the same proportional allocations reduced to the new optimum yield. These three options did not include monthly or seasonal restrictions on the fishery in any of the areas. So for analysis purposes, we used the distribution of catch by month in the areas for the 2009 fishing year. Option four was developed to maximize catch in Area 1A while achieving an inshore exploitation ratio of 0.24 to 0.28. Generally, we don't have separate assessments for the inshore and offshore stock components. We have one stock complex assessment with one FMSY or sort of overfishing threshold. And the exploitation ratio associated with FMSY is about 0.24. In order to minimize the risk of overfishing the individual stock components, the PDT ran a risk assessment that projects removals under these TAC options for each of the two stock components and provides an estimate of what the exploitation ratio for the stock components may be. The committee identified sort of a target on these three options of 0.24 to 0.28. So option four was developed in that 0.24 to 0.28 range while trying to maximize catch in Area 1A. Option 4A includes restrictions on fishing in Area 1A to July through September only, and option 4B restricts Area 1A fishing to May through July only. Option 5 is an option that tries to maximize the catch in Area 2 while achieving an inshore exploitation ratio of 0.24 to 0.28. And in order to do this, option 5 also restricts fishing in Area 1A to the July to September time period. And then option 6 is a balanced option that reduces the catches in 1A, 1B, and 2 in a more balanced way while achieving an inshore exploitation ratio of 0.24 to 0.28. And again, option 6 had to restrict Area 1A fishing to July through September in order to do that. I'm not going to go over this slide either. It's here for your reference, and it's in the document as part of the biological impacts. These are the projections, 3-year projections on the OFL levels and the ABC levels. We'll obviously need to redo these for the new ABC level, but it, you know, falls within the range of what we had in the document before. And so I will get right into the risk assessment, which is what the PDT used as an analytical tool to evaluate the relative risk associated with the various TAC options by simulating removals of the inshore component and the offshore component of the resource using the best available science about stock biomass, mixing rates, and catch distributions. Hopefully everybody's generally familiar with the herring stock complex and the fact that we have an inshore and an offshore component. The inshore component is much smaller than the offshore component and is sort of the limiting factor. The stock components mix seasonally in different proportions in areas 1A, 1B, and 2. So fishing in areas 1A, 1B, and 2 during certain times of the year may take more or less inshore fish. And what the risk assessment does is it uses the best information that we have about the size of the inshore stock, the mixing rates in the different areas and the seasons, and applies the TAC options to that in order to simulate removals of the inshore complex component and generate an estimate of what the exploitation ratio may be on that component. Again, the exploitation ratio associated with FMSY is generally 0.24. We don't have specific reference points for the stock components, so the idea was to minimize the risk of overfishing the inshore stock component by getting that exploitation ratio down more in the 0.24 range with the TAC options that are under consideration. The New Brunswick weir fishery takes all inshore fish, and we don't have much control over that fishery. We don't have any control over that fishery. So the risk assessment draws from the New Brunswick weir fishery landings from 1995 to 2008. That's 14 years of landings, and in each run of the risk assessment, it pulls one of those 14 years and assumes that all of that catch comes from inshore fish. There's no way to consider exploitation on the inshore component of the resource without considering the Canadian catch, because they are catching all inshore fish. The model randomly draws from inshore stock size ranging from 10% to 30%. This is the range that came out of the last benchmark stock assessment, and also pulls from the best available information about the stock mixing ratios and what proportion the inshore and offshore components mix in the various areas. The model simulates removals of the TACs 10,000 times and generates an exploitation rate for both the inshore component and the offshore component, which can then be compared to the exploitation rate equivalent to FMSY or some other target. FMSY is our overfishing threshold for the stock complex. This is a flow chart that just tries to illustrate how the risk assessment works. Again, let me see if I can get my laser pointer working. You start with the track biomass estimate, and you project your OFLs. You then apply your TAC options. You apply a New Brunswick weir catch from that time period that I was referring to, 1995 to 2008. You apply your stock mixing ratios, and you apply your inshore stock size, and you apply your monthly catch rates. You get a projected biomass and catch for the inshore and offshore components under the TAC options. You repeat that 10,000 times to generate an average exploitation ratio, which is catch over biomass for both stock components. And you can then compare that to FMSY or some other ratio to evaluate whether or not you have a high risk of overfishing a stock component. In terms of the results, the complete results are in Appendix 3 of the document for all of the options. There is a summary of the results in the main specs document. The ratio of the OFL to stock biomass was used as a proxy for target exploitation, which again is FMSY. There's some information in the document about FMSY and overfishing thresholds, and we took a look at what the general range for FMSY is for all herring stocks around the world, and generally the range is 0.2 to 0.3, which gives you an exploitation range of about 0.17 to 0.24. So our 0.24 FMSY was sort of on the higher end of that range. The committee identified a target of 0.24 to 0.28 in terms of developing the options for the risk assessment. The options that were considered and analyzed by the PDT were grouped into a high-risk group and a low-risk group. The high-risk group, all or most of the distribution of the results generated exploitation ratios higher than 0.24. And with the low-risk group, 40% or more of the distribution generated an exploitation ratio below 0.24. As has already been mentioned, none of the options under consideration propose a risk to the offshore component. The offshore component is significantly larger than the inshore component, so the inshore component is certainly the limiting factor in terms of evaluating risk and removals and trade-offs between the TACs in the management areas. This graph shows you, sort of illustrates the results in one slide here of the risk assessment. And what you want to focus on, this line right here going across each of the rows is the FMSY exploitation ratio, 0.24. And then the box plots are the distribution of the results of each option. The boxes represent 50% of the results. So as you can see, in these options up here, you're pretty close to the 0.24 ratio. In the options down here, for example, option one, 50% of your results are well above 0.24, and actually almost 100% are above 0.24 in some of these options. But when you take a look at this slide, what you want to focus on is the box, because that's going to give you 50% of your results. And the line going through the box is the median. And that can be compared to this line going across here at 0.24 to give you an idea of how risky or how risk-averse or how risk-prone the option may be relative to an FMSY exploitation ratio. The committee did identify, and I'll get into that in just a second, a modified version of option 2A. So these three boxes right here are sort of where we are, close to where we are with the committee's recommendation. In terms of special considerations with the risk assessment, hopefully this point has become clear through the morning discussion. Setting ABC at 90,000 or 106,000 accounts for scientific uncertainty, but does not prevent excessive mortality on the smaller inshore stock component. That has to be addressed by allocating that ABC to, or the stock-wide ACL to the various management areas. Removals in the risk assessment, removals from 1 year do not impact the starting biomass in the next year. The years are independent of each other. So if you blow it in year one, then that's not reflected in the analysis. The analysis assumes that you stay below the catch for the previous year. There's flexibility to change the monthly catch distribution in Area 1A without affecting the analysis and some of the options. For example, May through July catch can be distributed in any proportion in options 4A, 4B, and 6, which allows the quotas to be assigned to periods instead of months. I'm not sure. We can get into this discussion a little more later if we need to. And as you know and hopefully have come to understand, the Canadian catch has a large influence on removals of the inshore stock. Late year adjustments to the 1A TAC, if the management uncertainty buffer is not fully utilized, does not affect the outcome. In other words, we're assuming 14,800 for management uncertainty. Some years, the New Brunswick weir fishery takes more than that. In many years, they take far less than that. There could be a mechanism, and the committee is recommending such a mechanism, to allow for some additional catch to be reallocated to Area 1A late in the year if the New Brunswick weir fishery does not fully utilize what we have assumed to be the buffer for management uncertainty. There's some discussion in the document, and we've already heard about it this morning as well, about the economic impacts of these options. The economic impact analysis in the document focuses on five elements. One, the loss of revenues based on the stock-wide ACLs that are lower than recent years' landings. Two, changes in harvesting costs for seeking alternative fisheries and for fishing further from shore. Impacts to the lobster fishery from the reductions in Area 1A and from the seasonal restrictions in some of the options. Impacts to the mackerel fishery from reductions in Area 2. And impacts on processors. At the time that we put this analysis together, there were two alternatives for setting the ABC. Hopefully you've had a chance to review those in the document. And the difference economically between Alternative 1 and Alternative 2 in 2010, Alternative 1 kept the ABC at 145 for 2010. Alternative 2 went to 90,000. Assuming all those fish were taken, the difference is $13.6 million. In 2011 and 2012, with the 90,000 ABC, the potential loss of revenue for harvesters is $2.4 million. In terms of the impacts of having to fish further from shore and seek alternative fisheries, midwater trawl vessels are estimated to incur about $2,800 per day of additional operating costs. Bottom trawl vessels, $500 a day. Purse seine vessels, $1,300 a day for additional operating costs. But purse seine vessels are not likely to be able to fish offshore. There's a high degree of uncertainty as to whether or not Area 3 fish can make up for the losses in some of the other areas. This has been a complicating factor for the analysis and makes it very difficult to really quantify the differences between some of these options. The impacts of derby fishing under some of these options may be problematic because the seasons are very restrictive. Seasonal restrictions on bait on landings could cause price fluctuations and will impact consistency of supply of product. This will impact processors and bait dealers and make planning for business very difficult. It is estimated that a 10% increase in lobster bait costs will result in a 1.5% decrease in net returns for lobster fishermen. The availability of bait alternatives is unclear, but prices are likely to change. Timing will be critical, and predictability is a concern. There are likely to be increased on-land transportation costs and increased shipping and handling costs. And some herring and lobster dependent communities are of particular concern. They're particularly vulnerable because of location and lack of alternative employment. This is just a summary. Hopefully everybody's had a chance to read the analysis in the document. A lot of Maine's lobster communities have a high rate of dependence on lobster, high unemployment rates, and higher rates of families that are existing already below the poverty line. Business networks and relationships between bait dealers and lobstermen will be strained under these options. The impact on the one remaining sardine cannery in Prospect Harbor is a very significant concern because of the lack of steady product supply. Impacts on Vinyl Haven are of a concern. The Vinyl Haven is an island community that is dependent on lobster. And it's recognized that there will be challenges for Gloucester and New Bedford to maintain working waterfronts. There will be loss of supply, fewer lines running in the processing plants, loss of employment opportunities, and this will be these will be effects of reductions in all of the areas, as well as the potential impacts on the mackerel fishery and the potential loss of product from the mackerel fishery. The committee has recommended a modified option 2A. The numbers had to be adjusted because for whatever reason, and I don't know how it happened, but the numbers that were in the document in option 2A did not add up to the total optimum yield. So we did some adjustments at the committee meeting, and the committee is recommending a modified option 2A carried through all three fishing years, and I'll show you what those numbers are in just a minute. The committee is also recommending that language be included in the specs that says if by considering landings through October 15th, if less than 9,000 metric tons has been taken in the New Brunswick weir fishery, then 3,000 will be reallocated to Area 1A for November and December. This relates to the 14,800-ton management uncertainty buffer that we are including to account for New Brunswick weir catch. The committee is also recommending to set JVP, IWP, TELF, USIDC processing, and the TAC reserve at zero, and to set border transfer at 4,000 tons, which it has been since the beginning. The committee is recommending no research set-asides for 2010 through 2012, given the reductions in the TACs, and recommending that the fixed gear set-aside be reduced proportionately in Area 1A. It's currently 500 metric tons. Based on the committee's recommended TACs, the fixed gear set aside would be 295 tons. This table here provides the numbers that the committee is recommending. As you can see, the ABC would have to be changed to 106,000, which does leave an additional 16,000 tons of catch to deal with, which I'll get into in a minute. The management uncertainty buffer being 14,800 brings your stock-wide ACL down to 106,000 minus 14,800. So that would be adjusted, and DAH and DAP would have to be adjusted accordingly. The TACs that, or the sub-ACLs, whatever you want to call them, that result are identified here in the table, and under this option, the Area 1A TAC would be about 26,500 tons, Area 1B, 4,300, and Areas 2 and 3, about 22,100. Now, we have new advice on ABC and a new recommendation from the council that ABC be set at 106,000. I went back and forth with the PDT following the SSC conference call, and I really wasn't able to get a consensus from the PDT. But my recommendation is that if ABC is increased above 90,000, the additional catch should be allocated to Area 3. We've had some discussion of that already. The reasons are because the risk assessment suggests that the exploitation of the inshore component will be well above FMSY under the proposed TACs for the inshore areas. There's a high degree of uncertainty with the assessment. The stock is projected to decline under FMSY with average recruitment. Recruitment is uncertain, and three of the last 4 year classes have been below the median. And right now, the proposed TAC for Area 3 at 22,000 is very low relative to the size and the ability of the offshore stock complex component to sustain additional fishing effort. We actually have always wanted to encourage more fishing in Area 3. The offshore stock can support a much higher level of fishing effort than is proposed under the specifications for the next 3 years. In terms of the timeline, we are sort of hopefully nearing the end of the specs process. We got the recommendations from the advisors on November 9th. We got the recommendations from the committee on November 10th. Assuming we get final recommendations from the council here today, the specs package will be submitted by December 15th or somewhere right around there. Implementation will occur as soon as possible in 2010, and the quotas will retroactively apply. My understanding is that the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission will finalize their specifications in February 2010. Their process is much faster, and I think they wanted to wait and see what happens here at the council meeting before finalizing their specifications. And that's all I have. That's it.
Questions for Lori? Paul?
Just a quick question, Lori, and maybe Steve can help out. That it appears that the targeted exploitation rate for the inshore stock is between 0.24 and 0.28. And the risk assessments, when you determine a risk assessment for a particular option, do you, like, say, for instance, the risk assessment for 1A, do you consider that the Canadian weir fishery will, that risk assessment will be for 1A? So you consider the weir fishery as part of 1A?
Actually, I mean, I'll let Steve expand on this, but the risk assessment is for the inshore component, which is caught in 1A, 1B, and 2. It's not just Area 1A.
Okay.
It's for the inshore stock component, and we have information that suggests that all of the fish that are taken in the Canadian weir fishery are inshore fish.
So the 1A, 1B, 2, and also the Canadian weir is included in the risk assessment?
It's all of the Canadian weir, but then it's certain fractions of the catch in Area 1A, 1B, and 2, depending on the time of year that the catch is taken.
Right. So when you look at the risk assessment includes, even though the council said it's going to come off the top, it includes the fact that it's part of the inshore component. Okay. So then when we look at these different options, it's saying that the Canadian fishery is part of the inshore component in terms of the exploitation rate.
Right. What it does in the risk analysis, it uses that period of time of the Canadian, takes a random drawer every time it does an iteration. On average, that's about 16,300.
Okay. So when we get to particular options, would you be able to say that that option has an exploitation rate of 0.5 as opposed to 0.24, which is what we were looking for?
Well, I don't know if you could put the box plot on. What the risk analysis, it doesn't give you a point estimate. It gives you a whole distribution. And so you can pick out what fraction is above the 0.24 or below the 0.24. And so hope I don't blind anybody. And so in this case here, if you look at this is the no action, you could see that there's practically nothing in terms of any of the outcomes being below 0.24, which is the FMSY. And so you go across, here's no action. They're all above the 0.24. Get option one. This is alternative one is above. for the first year, and then you see most of the distribution. This is probably about 95% of the distribution of the outcomes come out above that level. Now, that's for the FMSY proxy.
So that means that if 0.24 is like the overfishing threshold, the higher you are, the insurer, the more overfishing of that nearshore component
is likely to occur. Right. And probably, like I said, here you're using a proxy for FMSY. And so you could think of this as being kind of fuzzy. You want to be someplace, you know, 0.24, 0.28. You know, you're not going to go too far. Where you get concerned is if you start looking at these median values, this line here, and you can see that these values are all up around 0.5, 0.6. When the stock collapsed, the exploitation rate on the stock on the whole, on the average, was about 0.41. And so to me, if you're looking at the risk, first risk is looking to see whether you're above this FMSY, but then I would start looking to see how this distribution compares to being above 0.41. And at that point, when you start getting much of the distribution above 0.41, then I think you're really putting the insurer component at risk.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, question for Lori and Steve, if I may. Okay. We keep referencing the insurer component, as we should, and we make statements regarding we are overfishing that component or we are not. Is there any specific definition, any specific plan element that would cite that indeed that is the definition of overfishing of the insurer stock, or is that basically a benchmark, some guidance that's been used that we should consider as we discuss the impact of these allocation strategies on the insurer portion of the Gulf of Maine?
No, we don't have an assessment for the separate stock components. We don't have overfishing thresholds. We don't have target fishing mortality rates. We are using the stock complex overfishing threshold, FMSY, as what we would consider a reasonable target. That exploitation ratio being 0.24, committee identifying around 0.24 to 0.28 for some of the options. We had this discussion at the committee meeting. The level of risk that the council wants to assume relative to fishing mortality on the individual stock components is a decision that the council can make. There are no targets or thresholds that we are required to meet. It is a plan objective to minimize the risk of overfishing the spawning components. And actually, we've never, or we shouldn't ever be referring to any of these options as overfishing the spawning component or the stock component. These options are either more risk-averse or more risk-prone for that to happen.
Thank you. That's the clarification I hope you would provide. One other thing. In the risk assessment results, the presentation that you just provided, there is a reference to low risk and high risk. So we have low risk options and high risk options. That's the slide shown on page 7 of your presentation. Just to clarify matters, is it appropriate to call it a high risk group versus a low risk group, or because it's all relative, basically we have a risk group of some characterization that would be around 0.24 as the approximate exploitation rate, and then as you get higher, you have a higher risk. So I'm just suggesting that when we use the word low and when we use the word high, we better be very careful because high suggests a problem, but not necessarily so. This is low risk and then a higher risk. Is it too high? Tough to say. Relative to the point that Steve made, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Steve, you mentioned correctly so the fact that we did at one time back in the 70s, I guess late 60s and 70s, we did collapse the insurer portion of the Gulf of Maine resource. And that occurred when we did not have any spawn enclosures. So fishing effort could concentrate on fish when they were pre-spawning and spawning. but certainly things have changed because the states, the way SMFC, have implemented a spawning closure and afforded that protection on aggregated species, aggregated fish, during the fall. So, should we consider that facet of sea herring management today versus then, in that there is an additional measure of protection already afforded for sea herring?
Well, certainly the spawning closures provide some protection to the fish when they're spawning and prevents disruption of the spawning schools, might give some protection to the egg masses that are on the ground. But I think if I look at the, going back at the historical risk assessment, it looks as if historically you're pulling off 50-60% of the January 1st stock on average. But that's spread out. If you look at the catch curve analysis, it looks like you have F on the inshore spawning component of greater than 0.6, which gives you exploitation rates greater than 0.4. Now, when the stock collapsed last time, much of the fishery was offshore, and the offshore component collapsed first, and then the inshore component went down. Then you had, the period of time it took to rebuild both. So I think that's the way that I would look at it. It seems, based on the analysis, that the exploitation rate on the inshore stock is much higher than it is on the offshore stock. It looks like the rates are well above what is FMSY for the whole stock. With that. And so the question is, how long can you maintain those kind of rates and still have sustainability on the inshore stocks?
One other point, Mr. Chairman. The collapse of the inshore portion of the Gulf of Maine resource was preceded by a collapse of the Georges Bank resource, and I remember that very well. It was decimated. The spawning aggregations had been wiped out by foreign fishing, and so eventually the inshore portion came back, perhaps because of the successful recovery of the Georges Bank stock. We don't understand that relationship that well, but I'm glad you made that point, Steve, because right now, as Laurie indicated, we have a very robust, healthy offshore resource.
Okay. Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I had a couple of questions. One was that Laurie made the statement that we know that the inshore stock is much smaller than the offshore stock, and I would say that we don't know that. There are some assumptions that are being considered that would lead one in that direction, but we don't know that. There's also, in the past, we've thought of the inshore stock as the strength of that stock repopulating Area 3, and we've talked about that over time fairly consistently. And the other thing is this idea of the inshore stock collapsed, and for those of us that were active in the fishery during that period, we were totally unaware that we were working on a collapsed stock. I mean, we were fishing. Our markets during that period were quite low. Canneries were closing at a fairly fast clip, trying to develop some bait market to supplement that, and that led us to the down the road to IWPs. But we had fish and certainly did not think that the inshore stock was collapsed. And I wonder what you base that on, Steve. Certainly we do see lower numbers in the stock assessment, in the survey through that period of time. But the survey doesn't cover the inshore stock all that well. And a lot of biomass just doesn't recruit to that survey, the inshore Gulf of Maine biomass. So I think it's only been in the last couple of weeks that I've heard people talk about the collapse of the inshore stock.
Well, that's the history as I know. I wasn't involved in Aaron back then, but that's the history as I know it. Now, what does the collapse mean? The general collapse is on the overall stock, and there's no doubting that at all. But if you get the catch rates, they drop down. You get a smaller pile of the stock. Things start to disappear. Some of the inshore wares and fisheries start to go down. Those kind of changes. That's how it would be manifest. But Matt Sierra's here. He may be a little more familiar with the history, and I'm more than willing to let him come up and speak to that.
Oh, that's quite all right. I think I'm really fine with the history. I got the history part down. I've been involved in the industry for quite some time, since the early 80s. And as I said, My husband started fishing for herring in 1981. I wish somebody had told him the stock was indeed collapsed if it was then, because he made a poor choice.
You can still fish on a collapsed stock. I mean, we have lots of history of stocks that people have considered collapsed, and you know, a fishery continues on it at a level much lower than what you would take if the fishery was rebuilt. So,
Dr. Jim.
Thank you. I have a question for Steve, if I may. I was looking at Appendix 2, which describes the risk analysis, and I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the assumptions about population mixing between the areas and how sensitive the results are to those assumptions.
I think the results are fairly sensitive if you start to move outside of the range of the values that we have here. So, for instance, we're pulling the values out between 0.1 and 0.30, both for the size of the inshore component to the total stock, and also for some of the mixing rates in Area 2. The way those values came out was based on a morphometric study. It was based on the NIMS area swept for the inshore component compared to the total, and a SSB, a acoustic survey in there. And the track in 2006 looked at those three values. They concluded 18%. We decided in the risk analysis instead of using 18% to use the range. If you go back to SOC 27, which I think is around 98, 99, somewhere around there, they did a comparison using the area swept for the previous 10 years. They came up with values of about 30%. There was a morphometric study that was done in the winter fishery. That exploratory analysis came up with a value, I think it was either 24% or 30. One of the two, one was 24, one was 30, but it was about the same issue. For the results of the risk analysis, to really shift those things, you have to start moving up to values that are up in the 40% or higher level. And when you get up to that level, then you can start bringing the risk to the inshore component down, but it doesn't seem like that's very likely. So, for instance, if you take the catch curve analysis and you get an F of 0.6 on the inshore component, and the stock wide F is 0.14, and you assume that's a mixed average, would mean that if you had no mortality on the offshore component, that the fraction of the inshore component would have to be about 24% in order to get an F on the overall stock of 0.14. So I think when you do things like that, it gets very hard to push the biomass numbers up high enough in order to get the risk assessment to put you in an area where you'd say, well, you know, I'm meeting my 0.24 exploitation objective.
Dave Gaethel.
I think Dr. Jim sort of asked my question, but I'm going to kind of rephrase it a little bit and try and so basically, as long as you keep the mixing rates between 0.1 and 0.3, the bars don't change much. Is that correct?
Yeah, if you keep the ratios in between those two levels and that where they occur in the areas in the month, these things aren't going to move. That's included in those distributions. So sometimes you'll get a high mixing rate, sometimes you get a low mixing rate. But you'd have to shift all of that, probably say instead of 0.1 to 0.3, you'd have to go, you know, 0.3 to 0.5 or 0.4 to, you know, 0.55 or something in that range to get the exploitation rate for the high risk ones down to below 0.24.
Right. Now, problem I'm struggling with is area 2, because that's where the mixing occurs. And what's the proper amount to remove from area 2 and still not affect the inshore component? And this is what I'm having a hard time pulling out of the story.
Yeah, that's built. You can't see the results here because they're all put together. But in essence, what it's doing, it's just taking the values that you have and applying when those catches were taken by month in each area. For area two, it's using that 0.1 to 0.3 during the year, saying somewhere between that, those two values, is what the catch coming out of the area belongs to the inshore component. In the analysis, where you get the real sensitivity is in area 1A, because at that time, in the fall and the spring, all the fish are considered to be inshore component. And so what you take out of 1A really influences the analysis. What you take out of 2 does, but to a less extent, because it's a smaller fraction of the fish coming from the inshore component.
Okay, and what comes out of the New Brunswick weir fishery is all inshore stock, right? There's none of that ascribed to the offshore stock at all.
Right, right. Now, you know, we hear complaints about, you know, the weir fishery and, you know, what stock it belongs to, but people need to realize that the weir fishery is part of the assessment. And so if you were to take the weir fishery out, the stock size would decline. And so you'd have a small stock size to work with.
But the people that are doing this are comfortable that, I mean, I know with Cod we have a pretty extensive interaction between the Bay of Fundy and Georges Bank. We don't feel there's the same type of interaction with herring, or we just don't know.
Oh, I'm sure there's interactions. You know, it's you know, you can't get it all. I'm sure there's some, you know, they may be mixing between 4X and going into a 5Z. There's some level of movement. We don't know what it is, but I mean, in this analysis here, we're just trying to work within that stock complex that we have in the assessment. It would probably get overwhelmingly complex if we knew what those values were, and trying to figure out how to bring that in.
So to summarize what everybody said, then the basic take home message is: if you want to get bang for your buck in the inshore component, it's got to come out of 1A.
Yeah, in general, that's where it's going to be. The catch will be most sensitive.
Anyone else? Questions for Steve, Lori, Jim Fair?
Yeah, just a quick question, please. I understand the reason for trying to separate the inshore from the offshore population. What I'm having a little bit of a problem with is the way Area 3 is drawn, where a good chunk of it is what I would consider inshore waters, and it's in between Area 2 and Area 1B, and I just wondered how that, you know, factors into your deliberations.
Yeah, it actually doesn't factor in at all. The portion that's inshore, there are going to be inshore fish transiting between those areas going through there. At the time year they're going through and where the catch coming out of 3 is, seems to be a very small fraction. And so in that case, we just said, well, we'll just put that, all of that into 3 and ignore any of the impacts. It's not likely to be very large compared to 2 forces coming out of 2, 1B, and 1A.
Okay. Looks like we've exhausted questions specifically on the presentation. We'll go to the motions. I'm sure more of the issues will come out. Dr. Jim, there you are.
Steve, I have one more question about the risk assessment. With the mixing rates, the way you're estimating the proportion of those rates, is it based on the static composition of different morphs in a region, or are you actually measuring movements of fish?
No, we have no tagging ability to track the fish. So in one case, if you conduct a survey when they're on the spawning grounds, then you can look at the ratio of, okay, how much do you find in the inshore when they're on the spawning grounds compared to the rest of the stocks. That'd be like the fall, you know, the fall survey, maybe a piece in the spring. For the morphometrics type work, I haven't seen the results of what was used in the stock. It seems as if you can tell differences in the stock post-spawning, but not pre-spawning. And when they're actually spawning, it's difficult because the shape gets distorted with the eggs. So we don't have the actual movements rates.
Frank.
All right. Thank you. The advisory panel met on the 9th of November, considered these. I chaired the advisory panel meeting. That's no reflection on the current chairman. We just decided that it would be a very contentious issue, and so I proceeded with chairing that. They had a series, they had four motions. They won't be on the board, but for fishing year 2010, the current specifications be rolled over for the fishing, and that for the fishing year 2011 and 12, the catch be equal to the average from 2001 to 2008. The AP also accepted the Herring Committee recommendations for JVP, IWP, border transfer, TALF, reserve, and U.S. at sea processing. The AP accept the Herring Committee's recommendations for research set aside unless the TAC remains at close or current levels. And the committee's recommendation was zero, so that may change a little here now. And the motion that the fixed year set aside be reduced proportionately based on the distribution of the TAC in Area 1 through the three-year period. And those are the recommendations from the advisory committee. If there's any questions. The Herring Committee met the following day, and the first motion was to recommend alternative 2, option 2A for the 2010-2012 specifications, area 1, 26,546 tons, area 1B, 4,362. Area 2, 22,146. Area 3, 22,146 for a total of 75,200. Management uncertainty was 14,800, and the ABC was 90,000. That's the recommendation from the committee. So I'll make that as a motion, and what we do from there, I'm not sure, because that changed from this morning.
Committee motion. Discussion on the committee motion. Terry.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how you want to incorporate the decision on the ABC that we made a little bit earlier, but I just want to give a little rationale for the committee's motion. It's probably no surprise that we had quite a prolonged discussion, and As we went through the day, the rationale for option 2A was acknowledgement of the significant scientific uncertainty in the 40% buffer that had been provided to us by the SSC. Concern of that the analysis contained many assumptions and estimates that had not been yet peer reviewed and should be so, and then incorporated in the next benchmark. And a huge concern about the socioeconomic impacts to multiple fisheries regions and states. We had a large number of communications and comments last week that from one end of the coast to the other, and all those reasons together resulted in this proposal. And when you're ready to talk about the ABC, I'm... All right. Sticking my neck out this week like I did last week. Given the substantial uncertainties in the PDT's recommendation that none of the options propose a risk to the offshore, I would move to amend the committee's motion that the additional 16,000 metric ton ABC be incorporated into Area 3.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Gaith. The discussion on the motion to amend the committee's motion. Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I support the motion, but in the committee motion it says ABC 90,000. I think as you're amending it, you might want to put an adjustment in there so it's no confusion.
For 106.
Yeah.
Karen, can you change the ABC value to 106 as part of the motion to amend? 106,000 metric tons. That would be consistent with the council's ABC recommendation.
Where it says ABC. ABC. Up top. $16,000.
You turn the 106 into 16,000. 16,000. Correct. I think we're good. Discussion. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, there would appear to be two choices, well, three actually, put it in Area 2, put it in Area 3, or maybe a blend between Area 2 and Area 3. However, clearly there is a great deal of interaction between the Area 2 fish and Area 1A fish. Therefore, to me, the best place to put this additional tonnage consistent with the Council's recent decision to go with an additional 16,000 tons is in Area 3. The Area 3 resource, as indicated by Lori, is in good shape. It's a robust resource. The value for Area 3 would increase to about 37,700 metric tons. That would be 16,000 plus... I'm not quite right. I'm using the wrong table. Yeah, 22,146 plus the 16,000. So that value of potential Georges Bank catch is, I believe, far less than what the current quota is for Area 3, which is about 60,000 metric tons. So this also represents a rather dramatic decrease in Area 3, even with the 16,000 being added in. So it has to go someplace. And that really is the best place for it. It provides more incentive for vessels to move to offshore fishing grounds where they belong, the large vessels in particular. And it minimizes the chances of there being any encounter of Area 1A fish and, frankly, provides more justification for actually having increased the ABC by 16,000 tons.
Mary Beth?
Well, I certainly do appreciate what Terry is trying to do with this motion. However, I would not support it. And instead of just looking solely at the numbers, I think we need to consider the percentages compared to current catch, historic catch, and what this means for the fishery. And if we were to allocate in this manner, we would have approximately 42% coming off the Georges Bank stock and 29% from the inshore stock. So we'd cut the... Compared to the historic catch, which is represented by option one, we would be cutting the Gulf of Maine in half and doubling the catch on Georges Bank. And I think we also would be increasing the likelihood that we're not even going to catch the 91. In recent years, there have been boats working on Georges Bank, and they have been out there looking for the fish. The fish showed up early this year, so they were able to start working in September, and everyone was very pleased by that due to the low tack we have in Area 1A. The year before, it was October before we saw any fish out there. So, I mean, we can play with these numbers all we want, but I don't think the fish are going to read the report when we're done, and they're going to be available when they're available. What we do know is that regardless of how many fish you think are Georges Bank spawning stock or Gulf of Maine spawning stock or what the ratio is, there's a huge amount of uncertainty around all of that. What we do know is that historically, in the stock assessment, you can see the numbers. For the past 50 years, the Gulf of Maine has been the most productive area for the fishery. I mean, and it just is what it is. I mean, we know certain times of year that there's going to be fish in the Gulf of Maine, and we don't know that about the other areas. So it's difficult for me to see this as precautionary when what we're doing is shifting catch. If you are able to take the whole catch, 50% in one direction for one area and 50% in the other for the other. And that simply just makes no sense to me. To me, when I hear the SSC give a report that the current catch is fine, it's not having a negative impact on this resource, That means current catch by area. That doesn't mean all of a sudden turn everything upside down, have huge economic impacts on coastal communities that can't, you know, do not have other jobs to turn to, and put the cannery below the break-even point. It just doesn't mean that. I can't see how people can get there based on this information. So for those reasons, I do not support this motion. And if I were to have an opportunity to make a different motion, it would be to scale up the numbers in option 2A with the increased TAC that we're looking at now.
Anyone else? Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was considering which option at the hearing committee level to select, I realized that the risk analysis was showing that the best ones would have been one of our last three options there, options 4 through 6, as far as protecting the inshore stock. But I also realized that this is new work that Steve has developed, and I think it he did a tremendous job given the information that he had. But I chose to vote with the option 2 because I feel that it's important that Steve's work and the PDT's work on the risk analysis should go to a peer review. And hopefully when we have our peer-reviewed stock or benchmark stock assessment in 2012, maybe we can get that analysis incorporated into the peer review. And so that's the reason I was willing to take a little less risk-averse option here.
Paul.
I just want to say something about peer reviews. People, now that we have an SSC, are thinking that everything that our technical bodies do should be peer-reviewed by the SSC, and we just can't afford to have that. And we've always relied on our PDT to provide technical reviews, and that their work is vetted through a number of state, federal academic scientists. So their work, unless they develop a model or do something extraordinary, I don't think we should get into a position by saying the PDT work should be peer-reviewed. We've never done that, and it's something to keep in mind. I just don't want us to think we're going to start having the PDT work peer-reviewed.
And I agree with you, Paul, on that, that we're not going to have everything peer-reviewed. I just think this is such an important part of what could potentially be driving our management in the future that I think this may be something that is worthy of having a peer review on. I would not certainly expect that every piece of work that a PDT did would be peer-reviewed.
Pat.
Yeah. Well, this is not a new analysis. I think that's important to point out. We have used this analysis in our decision making before. I support the motion to amend. I don't know if I support the original motion, frankly, but I support the motion to amend because the original motion, I think, is not as conservative as the PDT recommended. And that if we're going to be adding any additional catch, it shouldn't be in the inshore stocks. So I think at the very least, we need to look at adding this additional tonnage to Area 3.
Anyone else on the council? Rodney? No. Mary Beth?
Pat is right. This is not new analysis. It was done in the last specification setting process. And I didn't agree with it then, and I don't agree with it now. It wasn't as critical then as it is now that the numbers have changed. But I think the peer review part that needs to be done is the assumptions. The work that the PDT did is not bad work. It's excellent work. It's the assumptions that are used that go into the analysis that need to be peer reviewed through a benchmark stock assessment. And certainly would be on the list if and when we have one. And I would just point out that, you know, this been some discussion about the inshore stock collapsing. I don't know that it did or did not, but we're talking about driving removal rates down in this fishery below what the removal rate was during that period, and it makes absolutely no sense. And I just firmly believe that, you know, the economic impacts that will result from this are not justified.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I had a question for Steve Carrier, I think, if he could. As I understand the graphs that are here, I just want to make sure that the 2A numbers that are in the appendix are the 2A numbers that the committee actually ended up with. They aren't the original numbers. Is that
That's correct? That's not correct.
That's not correct.
This was based on the original 2A. They're close, and they're probably not going to change that much from it. But those figures are based on the old one because we just got those figures last week.
Okay.
So we didn't have time to update those.
Well, my point is that let's just assume that they're close. They're still on the more risky side. That's on 1A, right? As it stands right now, without proportionally scaling it up or anything else, which would only make it worse.
Right.
This is still on the risky side as opposed to the risk averse side.
This would be grouped in the high risk group. The numbers for this are not going to be that different than the original 2A. I have the numbers for the new 2A, but I don't have the figures. But it's going to be in the same ballpark as the old 2A and some of the other high-risk groups.
Right. So my point to the council in general in this case is that we're already, you know, I don't want to say on the wrong side of the risk curve because I'm not sure that's the right way of phrasing it, but we're not in the low-risk zone anyway. And if we were to change this and add these fish proportionally to areas 1A, 1B, and 2, as well as 3, we'd only be getting ourselves deeper into the risky territory. So that's why I seconded this motion. I think, we've already taken an element of risk, and I don't think we should just scale up the numbers and take even more risk.
David, what page were you on? Which document?
They don't have page numbers. I'm in Appendix 3, and there's simulated catch over inshore biomass, option 2A, simulated inshore biomass are the headings. And then there's ones on the following pages for offshore. But they don't have page numbers. It's about, I'm going to guess, 20-odd pages into the document.
Yeah. 106. Is that the same thing as page 106 in the main document?
Yes. The figure on page 106 is your simulated catch over inshore biomass. For option 2A. Those are the only graphs that are provided in the document. There's a series of graphs for each option provided in the appendix.
And what was the exploitation value on option 2A?
That is reflected in the table on page 116. And the median into the it's about 0.41. You want to look at the median values, and you're looking at essentially alternative 2 for 2010 and 1 for 2011 and 12. It's 0.41 is the median value.
Yeah, there will be one place where you will see some difference between the old 2A that you have in your tables and your figures, and the new one is that in the old one, the numbers were adjusted in 2011 and 2012 to try and get the same exploitation rate as you got in 2010. Here, we're using those same values for all 3 years, but the stock size is dropping. And so what will happen is in 2011 and 2012, the risk will shift a little bit higher, get riskier for those 2 years because stock sizes drop. And to give you an example of what those numbers would be, if you are using the median, which is right in the middle of that distribution, in 2010, it's 0.42. In 2011, it's 0.46. And in 2012, it's 0.50. And so you can see that creep and a little shift in the later years.
So option 2A with the 106 ABC that we've identified for the next 3 years has an exploitation value for 2010 of 0.42, did you say?
That would be the median. That's what comes out right in the middle. And so if I go down to the 25th, which means 75% of the exploitation rates are above that level, the values would be like 0.35, 0.38, 0.41. And so when you look at this new option, roughly 75% of the distributions are at or above that 0.41 level that you should feel fairly uncomfortable at.
And then in 2011, you said it's the median's 0.46, in 2012 it's 0.5.
That's my preliminary numbers that I did. I ran between last week and here. They haven't gone through the PDT yet. It's just I took those numbers and cranked it through for this meeting.
The new numbers, the 0.42, 0.46, and 0.5, haven't been vetted through the PDT.
They have not been vetted through the PDT.
Okay. And the recommendation from you on this issue was to try to seek a value between 0.24 and 0.28.
Well, the council chose, or committee. The committee, before we ran the risk analysis, looked for values between 0.24 and 0.28 in terms of where they were trying to get the values. And, of course, when you had those two options, you have one set of risks that, absolutely well above that. And then you have those low groups, which does a pretty good job of hitting 0.24, but it has some fairly horrendous economic and social costs.
Right.
So I'm glad I'm on the PDT and not on the council.
Lori?
I want to be clear on what the PDT recommendations actually are. The PDT is not recommending a specific option. The PDT is not recommending a specific exploitation ratio. What the PDT is saying is we've done the analysis. We've evaluated the risk. FMSY for herring stocks around the world ranges from 0.2 to 0.3, which gives you an exploitation ratio of about 0.17 to 0.24.